Succession number 28709, reel number 2.
This is Bunty Lawson, reel 2.
Before I go on and with the cipher school bit, I'd like to recap and say that arriving at 13 Group headquarters in Newcastle was quite the most uncomfortable time of 6 years of war. Nothing was organised. The ops room where we worked on the big map was still in a wooden building. Transport to get to work, even at 4 o'clock in the morning, was a commandeered White Horse whiskey lorry. And anything more uncomfortable, I don't think the whiskey had anything to do with it, than sitting at the back of an open lorry in the northeast of England in a particularly cold winter was an extremely uncomfortable experience. Soon after that, I can't remember how many weeks, but it was weeks as opposed to months, we moved into a specially built underground ops room with a beautiful new map for us to work on. And it was meant to be, I think, gas-proof, bomb-proof, and everything else. I don't think it was ever actually put to the test. And also, we were collected in a commandeered bus, which was at least closed in. Now I can go back to my course before the...
Just one last question, because you were mentioning that you had very strict shifts, was it? Four on and four off.
I think I said that earlier on.
I was just wondering whether you suffered any form of sleep deprivation. Did it affect your work at all?
I don't think it did, actually. But we were sort of permanently tired. And I think it was bad for our metabolism altogether, because you never had any sort of routine food at set times. And when we were actually on duty, sitting around the ops table, an airman was dispatched every now and again. Where he went to get it, I don't know. But he used to come back round with literally buckets of coffee or tea or OXO, which all tasted very much the same. And we would drink it out of absolutely filthy and very chipped enamel mugs. We must have had constitutions of I don't know what, because it didn't seem to affect any of us. And when he brought round the OXO one, he used to say, "Blood? Who wants a mug full of blood?" It was rather off-putting. But by that time, he was so desperate, he would have drunk anything that was hot and wet.
How did you manage to get any sleep if you only had very few hours off? Did you actually manage to get back to the bed and fall asleep? Or did you always think, I have to wake up in a minute?
You went back to bed and just flung yourself on the bed and slept if you could.
And did anybody come to wake you up?
Do you know, I don't remember. We all had alarm clocks. But the difficult thing was there was no routine to it. And I worked fairly difficult shifts the entire war, except for the last bit with the Air Ministry, Whitehall, where we always had a full complement of workers per watch. And the most humane watches, we had a four-watch system there. We did the same thing 2 days running. So we actually did two nights in a row, and they were long nights. I think it was 8 o'clock at night till 8 in the morning. We did that for two nights running, but then we got 2 days off. Mostly the watches we did, we'd done 8 hours overnight, and they counted that as your day off, which was a cheat. You'd done 8 hours work. But they said, well, if you counted from, say, midday until midday the next day when you went on duty, that was 24 hours. But that was a terrible cheat, really. But when you had 2 days off together, it was splendid because you slept the first day and you lived the second. But it took me 6 years to get around to somebody who did this humane way of working.
But of course, when you were doing these very intensive shifts, you weren't having to do your own shopping or your own cooking or washing or anything like that?
No. Only when we were living out did we do our own shopping. And we didn't. Yeah, we did quite often live out. But you could always eat in the mess if you had to. Washing, yes, we did. Haphazardly.
Now we should get on to the Cypher School.
Now, yes, Cypher School.
Whereabouts was that, and what date are we talking about? This
We're talking about May 1940. And I presume it was in one of the colleges, but I can't at this stage remember where. I didn't like doing ciphers. I didn't like Oxford. It was very hot. I had hay fever for the first time in my life, so it was not one of the most happy times. Anyway, I scraped through my exams and then was posted down as cipher officer. Two of us went together, a girl called Pauline Atherley and myself. She was marginally older than me, and her father had been in the RAF, so she knew much more about the whole workings of the whole organisation than I ever did. And as I say, she passed her cipher exams with better marks than I did. They couldn't very well have been much lower, I think, than mine. And so she was obviously the senior one. And there we did, at first, we were the only two cipher officers on the station, so we did 24 hours on and 24 hours off. With the 24 hours on duty, we had a bed down in the headquarters building, so apart from immediate signals, and most immediate, the ordinary routine signals, we didn't bother to either encipher or decipher until the following morning at the proper working hours. So it wasn't quite as bleak as it sounded. And we ate in the officer's mess, which meant we were on call if anything urgent happened. We could get back to the office within 5 minutes. And looking back, I don't think anyone now at the age of, I suppose I was just 19, we had to walk through the camp, which was of course in pitchy blackness, to our office. There was no torches, no lights, and we were alone in this big headquarters building all night. And I don't ever remember being frightened. One had sort of complete trust in people, I suppose, then. Anyway, there was a fighter squadron on the station, 92 Squadron, who eventually became a very famous squadron in the Battle of Britain. And they were there, I think I hero-worshipped the entire squadron, not any one particular pilot. I just thought they were all absolutely marvellous. I had quite a good good social life there, either in the mess or we used to have parties at the local golf club. Didn't play golf, but we had good parties there. And as soon as the Battle of Britain started, they were recalled up to Biggin Hill and took a very, very active part in the battle. And 79 Squadron were taken out of the battle area and sent down to Pembrey to reform and rest, virtually. And I thought they were a very inferior squadron. 92 was still my most favourite, and always has been. I still think of the whole squadron with immense affection. And 79 were flying Hurricanes, which I didn't think were anything like as glamorous as the Spitfires of 92. I don't think I'll repeat the Hurricane story.
Do you have any stories about the 92 boys, though, when they were at Pembrey? Anything that you're allowed to repeat?
I don't think it was anything particularly special. No, they were just great, good fun.
And can you give any of the names?
What are the famous ones? Yes, I mean, he was known as Tucky in those days. Once he was famous, he was Roland Stamford Tuck, who I think was about one of the most decorated pilots. Brian Kinkham, who really, he wasn't the CO of the squadron, but he led the squadron. And he was a famous name. Who else was there? Tony Barclay. He was more famous for marrying Deborah Carr, as much as he was for as a pilot. Roy Mottram, who was a particular friend of mine. When I was on leave, I used to go from home down to Biggin Hill, usually for a party, with Roy. And Alan Wright, who I think is still alive. I think Titch Havercroft. I think that's enough for one squadron.
Are these the ones that you have the photos of?
Yes. Most of them.
Because I know that's the sort of thing that the researchers like to hear about.
Oh. Well, at the time of making this, whatever you call it.
Recording,
thank you. I've got photographs of quite a number of 92 Squadron. And I think an epic one of the Spitfires lined up in a grass airfield. I mean, it just sort of dates the whole thing.
And that's at Pembrey.
Yeah. So if the museum wants the photos, they're willing to have them copied.
I'll make a note. Let you know. So what were your everyday duties at Pembrey?
Well, just ciphers.
Now, you can take it for granted that you know what ciphers is, and some people listening to this tape will also know how it works, but for the benefit of people like me, who have absolutely no idea.
Well,
from the basic principles,
principle was you had a message in plain English, and you put it into cipher, or various ciphers. There are five RAF ciphers. There was the Typex, there was book ciphers, and the other three, quite honestly, were codes, which we never used, because you can break a code down without books and things. And
ask how you actually put something into a cipher, though? You weren't using a code book, were you using a machine?
We were using a book for the book ciphers, but the Typex machine, which I hated, as the devil hates holy water, because I couldn't touch type, and they have an ordinary keyboard, typewriter keyboard, but not nice and easy to plop down. You have to give them a good old plop to get the letters to stay down. And literally, what you type in English, plain English, comes out of one drum at the side on a strip. And the machine puts it into code, because you've set up various drums and spindles inside the machine, which are the code for that day. And that comes out in cipher, again on a sticky strip of paper, on the right-hand drum. And you simply stick that up onto a big sheet of paper, and then that goes over the air, and if the enemy happens to pick it up, you just hope he hasn't got the setting for the day and he can't decipher it. Likewise, if it comes in cipher, you type this absolute nonsense onto your keyboard and it comes out in the other drum in plain English.
Now, if you couldn't touch type, that must have been incredibly difficult.
Well, I had to, you know, more or less one finger typing.
And did you ever make a mistake? Sort of type the wrong letter at the wrong time and then...
Well, in which case you have to say erase. And if you come across a bit that won't decipher, you send back to signals for a check and repeat to see if they have made a mistake. Because the vital cipher came through that if we were going to be invaded after Dunkirk, and mine became undecipherable about two-thirds of the way through, which was agony for me and for half the station, the station commander, the squadron commanders, everybody was standing at my elbow. And I had to send through then to signals to get a check and repeat on groups, because they came through in groups of four. and gave the numbers of the groups, and they had received them incorrectly or typed them incorrectly. And when I got the correct version at long last, and about 2 stone lighter, I got the plain version out for everybody. But it really, that one really was vital, and it was, I think, probably the nastiest moment of my long war.
And what a moment for that to happen.
It was very, very nasty.
How long did that go on for? Was it minutes or...?
It seemed like a lifetime to me, but I think it was probably about 15 to 20 minutes at the outside.
So can you remember how the message went? Can you remember where it got to before it started becoming garbled?
No, I can't. It was about a third of the way through it. So there was quite a lot more to be come out. And you see, half the people waiting at my elbow to get the English, the, you know, the translated, the decoded, I'll get the word right in a minute, message, they didn't realise that it wasn't just me making a mistake. For once, it wasn't. The moment I was given the correct things to type, it came out perfectly easily. But they didn't understand that. And it was all far too complicated to start explaining to them. I did try, but I don't think any of them believed me.
And how old were you? How old were you at that time? Still a teenager.
I was 19.
The weight of responsibility.
It was yes. I think responsibility. It was like running yearlings in 3-year-old racing.
That sounds to me as though that was probably the most extreme moment at the time at Pembrey.
I think the most extreme responsibility was in the Y Service.
Mm. Which came along?
Several years later. Now I was arrived at the age of 21 by that time.
Now, how long were you at Pembrey for?
Do you know, I can't remember. It must have been about a year. Pauline Atherley, who went there with me, we had the same badges of rank as the RAF, but we didn't have the same ranks. An assistant section officer, which you were when you were first commissioned, was the same as a pilot officer, and a section officer was the same as a flying officer. And when one cipher officer per station was allowed to be promoted to section officer, I was promoted and she wasn't. Well, as she had always considered herself my senior, I don't think she could stand that. And she asked to be posted.
Okay.
Back on again. Somewhere along the line, I think I'd been at Pembrey probably just over a year, and I was posted to number 82 group at Stormont in Belfast. And Stormont was just being opened as a group headquarters then. It was situated in their actual Stormont parliamentary buildings, but it was only in its infancy. And the cipher office was just, I didn't do anything there except amend, bring all the cipher books up to date. And I was bored stiff of doing that, so I asked to be sent out to one of the stations where I could do some proper work. And I was then posted out to another fighter station, Ballyhalbert, down on the Ards Peninsula, which was a dispersed station. In other words, there were bits of it all over the place. So if there was a bomb, which was slightly unlikely in Northern Ireland, Belfast itself was meant to have a blackout, but it didn't. It was known as the Celtic Twilight because quite a lot of the lights were still on in Belfast, because I don't think they really considered the war was on their doorstep at all. And Ballyhalbert was extraordinary. I think they must have built the airfield on the Ards Peninsula in the summer. And it had the open sea on one side and the lock on the other. And come the winter, when it rained incessantly, it more or less sank. We never seemed to see daylight for days on end. And you were always soaked, because being a scattered station, you were always halfway between the mess and your quarters, or your quarters and getting down to the ops room. And the risks I ran there were mostly the cipher officer office was down in the ops control room, which was, I suppose, a couple of miles away from the mess. And we were allotted a Humber shooting break to get on and off duty from the mess down to the ops block. And I didn't have a driving license. I still had a temporary driving license. I'd never taken a test. And I used to drive this blinking great Humber Snipe. Luckily, I'd never met any traffic, but it literally was as wide from wheelbase to wheelbase as the lane itself. Fortunately, I never, ever met a car coming the other way, because I'm not quite certain what would have happened, but I did it day after day there, and nobody seemed to ever query it. And because most of us were actually lived, our homes were mostly on the mainland, if you got leave from Northern Ireland, you were allowed 48 hours travelling time. And I did very well at this, because I used to get one of the squadron to fly me, either in the Magister or a Tiger Moth, into Belfast. From Belfast, I caught a splendid, I think it was an Anson, which was the ADLS, Air Dispatch Letter Service, aircraft, delivering mail and letters, actually to London, but we always stopped off at Speke on the way, Liverpool. And then we landed at Hendon. From Hendon, I took a tube up to London, caught a train home from Waterloo to Camberley, and I was home in a matter of hours between getting out of the office and arriving back with my parents, which was absolutely... I cannot to this day remember who told me about the ADLS splendid little airplane that that flew from Belfast to Hendon. But it was a great help to me. But on the whole, we had fun at Ballyhalbert. I think it was probably because it was such an awful station. There was no entertainment. There was nothing there except mud. But we used to have ridiculous competitions in the mess, where you rushed in. The whole station had to do it, all the squadrons. We had two squadrons there. There was 205, which sitting in Nottingham, and there was 25 squadron, which flew night fighters, bow fighters. And you had this competition, was you played so many rounds of darts, and then you played skittles, and then you played shove halfpenny. And then, if you were lucky, you could get in a game of table tennis in the evening, and you scored so much per thing. And I've forgotten whoever won it, but it was, you'd rush in to say, oh, good, I've just got time for a shove halfpenny match against somebody. And it was very childish, but it was quite pleasant. And we all drank a great deal of beer, because I can't remember drinking anything else there.
So it made up for a lot.
It made up for a lot, because... wasn't anything else to amuse us. I used to wangle trips when they were air testing the bow fighters. I flew quite a long way, and obviously it wasn't a passenger aeroplane in any way. There was the pilot, who obviously sat in front, and then he had an operator, navigator, who was right down in the tail. But you could stand behind the pilot, providing you didn't mind standing up the whole time. And as I loved flying and loved aeroplanes, and I flew miles around the mountains of Mourne and all over the place, standing up in the back of a bow fighter. Very rashly, I was taken up to about 19,000-20,000 feet without any oxygen. I don't suppose that did me much good in the long run. But as there was nowhere for me to plug into any oxygen anyway, the pilot had some and the operator at the back had.
Do you remember noticing any ill effects while you were up there?
Not while I... Well, yes. The pilot called up one day and said, was I all right? And I said, my hands were frozen. So he said, well, on your right-hand side, there's a sort of hot tube there. Put your hand on that, it'll warm them up. And I watched my hand floating over to catch onto this metal tube as if it belonged to somebody else. I was fascinated by it as it slowly found its way over to the tube. And another time, there was a slightly hairy moment when there was a sort of terrible shudder right through the bowfighter, and an awful lot of cold air seemed to be rushing in on one. And even the pilot said, what the bloody hell has happened to that? So the operator at the back said, the back hatch has fallen open. So he said, well, you better come forward and close it. And he said, well, I can't, Bunt is in the way. So he said, well, you swap over places. So I had to creep around the edge of this gaping hole with large chunks of Northern Ireland flying under my feet until I reached the operator at the back, and he then had to creep forward where he could lean over from the back of the pilots, where the pilot sat, to close the hatch again. But it was all right. It was all quite exciting.
Well, at least they didn't make you do it.
I'm very surprised they didn't, actually. And I wasn't really officially meant to be down at flights at all. And there was a terrible flap on one day because the visiting senior air staff officer from group headquarters had come, and he was coming down to flights to talk to the air crew. So they didn't know what to do with me, so I was hustled into a sort of wardrobe place where there was an awful lot of those fur-lined jackets they flew in, which are Irving jackets. So it was terribly hot in there and not slightly smelly. And I had to sit there, gasping for breath, while the senior air staff officer, whose name was McGregor, came and thankfully eventually went. I met him years later, socially, and I told him what an uncomfortable hour or so he'd given me in the days of my misspent youth, and he thought it was hilariously funny. I said it wasn't at the time.
So you were never actually caught out doing any of these things?
I think I was caught out several times, but I was never actually punished for it.
Bit of a charmed life then.
Yes, and I had a very useful, and I can't remember which station commander gave it to me, slip of paper, which says this officer has permission to fly, which I really hadn't, but he gave it to me, and I just kept it forever.
Very useful.
And it was very useful. I used it for years and years and years.
Even outside of Northern Ireland?
Oh, yes. Yes, it came out to the Middle East with me. Do we get on to the Middle East? Because several times I had put in for overseas. And each time I did, I was firmly told that I would not be sent overseas until I was 21. So I'd actually gone home on leave, hoping to be able to spend my 21st birthday there. And in the meantime, my posting overseas came through on my 21st birthday. So I had to go back to Ballyhalbert by air, I think. I'm not sure. I can't remember that time. Because I then had to have all my jabs for overseas. And we were still not told where we were going. But I was given a list of things I had to buy for my overseas posting. And as they were all khaki drill, it seemed quite obvious that we weren't going to Russia, that we could be going to a hot climate.
I just have to stop you there for the end of reel two. This is Bunty Lawson.